This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We are having a full committee meeting on June 23, 1987 at 1:15 p.m. in Hearing Room 343. We'll have a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2193, 2196, 2324, 2557, 3348, and 3351.
Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order at 1:20, and I'll have a public hearing on House Bill 2196. One witness, Jim Mountain.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Mountain, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, here to urge your favorable action on House Bill 2196 that unanimously passed the House. This bill relates to appeals. It's designed to deal with a critical problem in appellate practice today, and that's premature appeals, essentially appeals from non-appealable orders. Here's the problem. Under the current law, the statutes provide that once an appeal is taken, the trial court is deprived of all authority and power to act on the case. And it's only the appellate courts that can do anything about that matter, which is fine, because most appeals are filed after a trial is all over and the case as it is at final judgment. But what is happening with all too frequently occurring regularity now is that parties are filing notices of appeal before a final judgment has been entered, for example, right in the middle of trial. A party that's aggrieved by an evidentiary ruling, instead of waiting until the final judgment to see whether they actually lose the case, in any event, files a notice of appeal in the appellate court, which, under current law, deprives the trial court of any power to do anything more. What happens is that the trial court then is in a situation where it may have witnesses ready, it may have other proceedings, it may have other final activity to do, but it can't do anything about it. In a recent case, the Murray well drilling that's referred to in the written testimony that I filed with you today, the court said there's just nothing we can do about it under the current law and cited a few cases, prior cases, that had urged that there be some legislative fix to this problem. What the Department of Justice has done is work closely with the Judicial Department to come up with some language that the appellate judges, the trial judges, and the Department of Justice as the state's major appellate litigator can live with that we hope resolves the problem. And simply what the bill does is when a notice of appeal is filed, say in the middle of a trial before a final judgment, instead of the current practice where the trial court doesn't have any authority, this bill would give the trial court the authority to make a determination as to whether or not an appealable order really has been filed. The trial court can do two things. It can take a look at this thing and say, geez, this is obviously a non-appealable order. I am going to go ahead and finish this trial. Or it can say, geez, this might be kind of a sticky one. I'm going to stay proceedings in the trial court. This bill also has a provision that allows the trial court to refer the matter directly to the appeals court for a quick ruling. Now, that's the first way to deal with the problem. Questions were raised, well, what about that recalcitrant trial judge who's not going to let any case go up on appeal and who's going to hold it as long as he can, even when an appealable order or a colorably appealable order has been filed? For that, we propose in this bill that the Court of Appeals, or the appellate court, have the power itself to say, well, we're going to stay proceedings in the trial court and determine whether or not this is appealable. Now, what the problem has been is suspending these trial court proceedings, and if we're proposing more appellate court action, aren't we just coming up with another procedure that keeps elongating the process? To that, we say no. What we propose in this is when an appellate court takes an issue of the appealability of an order and rules in summary fashion, that the whole appellate process on that specific issue will be speeded up. The appellate courts have the power to change the timelines and speed them up. The Supreme Court has the authority, the direction from this body to expedite that process. That, in a nutshell, is what this bill does. As I said before, this is one that has been worked out between the Justice Department and the Judicial Department. The Chief Justice supports this bill, and there should be plenty of letters in the file. There's only one thing that I would urge you to add to what the House has done in its fine efforts, and that's to add an emergency clause to this. That would be a Section 4 to this three-section bill.
Any questions?
Now, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to prolong this, but we have a piece of statute that's being considered in another committee that I'm aware of, which would expedite a legislative action on a question of constitutionality to the Supreme Court. Do you think that's constitutional?
You mean whether it offends the notion of separation of powers?
I don't know. Senator
Cohen, there have been challenges to statutes that would expedite those proceedings. I think the most recent case that I can think of held that didn't necessarily create a separation of powers problem where it didn't go to affect the orderly business of the court.
That was
this is one that the court would visit upon itself because it has helped draft the language in this bill.
My recollection that was in the sales tax bill, came out of the 85 session.
And they took it up and dealt with it. Yeah, I understand that. I just wanted to kind of his little comment on that.
Senator Hill.
Yes, I guess, Jim, and maybe I missed something in what you're saying. I guess I'm trying to decide why we need this bill, and I'm a little troubled, for example, with the trial court making a determination about whether an appellate court has jurisdiction.
An understandable question, and one that the court raised in earlier drafts of this when we were reviewing it with them. What this focuses on is a legal decision by the trial court of whether or not this judgment itself is a final judgment, whether it is an appealable judgment. That is a legal decision that a trial court, you know, as a judge, can make. It's not necessarily determining what the scope of the authority of, say, the Court of Appeals is. And that, I think that's one reason, Senator Hill, why there is this additional check in this bill that the appellate court, if it thinks that a trial court is misinterpreting the law or going too far, it can itself stay all trial court proceedings and decide the appealability issue.
Okay, so the trial court would give the appellate court notice of its decision, I assume?
Yes, I mean, that would have to be, there's specific provisions in here for how the appellate court lets the trial court know what's going on, and there will have to be rules to that. If there are problems in the notification going the other way, those can be taken care of through the Supreme Court's rulemaking process under the rules of appellate procedure.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and so right now then, any time that an appeal is filed, things are automatically stayed at the trial level, is that okay?
That's correct. Right. That's correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's always been the rule in Oregon since we've been a state, hasn't it?
That has been the rule, certainly as far as decisions going back to 1916 that I've taken a look at.
This bill that you're offering here is certainly something that's new in Oregon law as far as you know.
Well, it is new in this sense that in tracking the cases from, say, 1916, there are a couple in the 40s and 50s that kind of questioned the rule. And there's one that even wavered from it, and that it was then, like in the 1960s, when people started citing that case, that even since then there have been recommendations that there be a legislative change.
I guess the point of my question is that there really isn't any great horrendous rush on getting this thing to take effect, and I'm very reluctant, frankly, to recommend amending this bill by putting the emergency clause on.
We'd certainly like to see the bill, you know, even without the emergency clause. The reason I pose that to you is that I think that in the last month there have been three more cases where this has occurred, and that's why we proposed the rush. But we would certainly take it any way we can get it.
Any further questions? All right. The chair moves House Bill 2196. The floor do pass. Discussion? Call roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. So ordered.
Thank you.
Let's see. Now we have House Bill 3351. There are no, I don't think there are any witnesses on this thing. We had a chance to look at that now, members. I'll call your attention one thing only, and that is on page 2, beginning on line 10. That's new language that has already passed both houses in another bill. And it's not going to hurt to do it again, but I want to point out that we've already done it once in this.
Are you worried about smoking?
No. Now, am I right? There are no witnesses on this. At least I don't have a sign-up sheet. Does anybody have any questions about this bill? All right. Chair, move this bill out. Do pass. Call a roll on it, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. On, let's see, House Bill 3348. Now, what happened to the witness sheets I just had here a minute ago? Now? Well, maybe we don't have any witnesses on that one either.
Testimony, however, in support. You know.
House Bill 3348. Do we have any witnesses on that?
Here's the sheet right here.
I got the sheet right in front of me. Don't have any witnesses on it. Mr. Mountain, did you have anything you wanted to say on that? Or do you know anything about it? All right.
Yeah, I'd say so.
This deals with the conditions under which a defendant will be allowed to file a late appeal in a criminal case. I have not been contacted, and other than what's in the measure summary in the bill itself, I can't tell you anything about it.
Waiting for something to happen, Mr. Chairman.
We do have
this bill is one of these that are...
Okay, there is. There is testimony in the...
In support of the bill. I'm
sorry. All right. Well, apparently it's the Judicial Department apparently is the principal sponsor on this. Anybody have any questions or concerns about this bill? All right, the House will move, the Chair will move House Bill 3348, do pass to the floor. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Aye.
House Bill 2557. Frank Gruber, you want to come up here a minute? 2557.
Give it up to somebody else.
Oh, wait a minute. We got to move this thing back, don't we? Did we move off the floor?
It's off the floor, isn't it?
Yeah.
I believe so.
Yeah, we brought it off.
Yeah, no, we've got it back.
We brought this back to our committee. And sit down. The chair moves that we reconsider House Bill 2557. Any objection? It's so ordered. All right, now, counsel or Frank or both now explain why this thing's back in their laps, will you please?
Mr. Chairman, this bill, which originally had a relating clause relating to probation, was used to add on some amendments in an earlier Senate Judiciary Committee work session. And those amendments consisted of several sections, some of which were relating to probation and some of which were relating to parole. I talked to your committee counsel and suggested that there would probably be a problem with the relating clause since the initial relating clause was just relating to probation. And pursuant to that conversation, we did an amendment to the relating clause. It was my understanding that I know the House does not accept amendments to relating clauses on the House side, but it was my understanding that that would be all right on the Senate side. Mr. Kramer also thought that would be all right and discovered after, apparently, that it was taken to the desk that that's still a problem because it was a House bill, and so it would still be a problem going back to the House. So Mr. Kramer asked...
Yes, Senator Cohen.
It's a problem in the Senate, too, Frank. You may say that it isn't, but it really is.
Well,
we try not to do that.
I mean, you may try not to do it, but my understanding is that it's permitted in the Senate, and it's absolutely not permitted under the way the House desk is operating.
Senator Hamby.
Yeah. Just this morning, Senator Cohn, we passed two out already this morning with tremendous additions to relating clauses. We passed three yesterday afternoon with altered relating clauses.
I'm talking about amending the first part of the wording. I'm not talking about the additions to.
The only part of the relating clause that really is significant is the part before the first semicolon. And it's a constitutional question whether you can have a bill that's not encompassed by the relating clause. And so if you're adding something in that goes beyond the relating clause, you have to adjust the relating clause or you can't add that material in. And that was the bind that this bill was caught in. So Mr. Kramer asked that I redraft the amendments, leaving out the part that dealt with parole, and that the bill be brought back now in its B engrossed version, and that these amendments, having been adjusted to deal only with probation, again be that the B engrossed version be amended to do away with the parole part, and that's why it's back before you, as I understand it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hammer, go ahead.
Frank, I have a real problem with deleting, or currently the bill, or originally the bill read, A engrossed, relating to probation, semicolon, amending ORS. So could not we just add the section that relates to probation to the bill, rather than deleting, persons convicted of a crime, as you are proposing to do in your amendment?
Because the amendments that were being made to the A. engrossed version dealt with parole as well as probation, I amended your relating clause so that instead of just saying relating to probation, it said relating to, I believe, persons convicted of crime. I don't have it in front of me.
Yes.
So that it would pick up both people who were going through probation and people who were going through parole. But that is not permitted. You can't, apparently under your rules, under the legislative rules,
That's
which
right.
is not a constitutional, but under the legislative rules, the House desk would not accept that change. If I couldn't make that change, then there's a constitutional problem in adding the section dealing with parole into the bill.
So, in other words, you cannot just leave the current related clause reading, relating to persons, pardon me, relating to probation, semicolon, amending ORS 137.550, and another ORS that would pick up ORS 010.
No, the part of the relating clause that comes after that first semicolon doesn't matter. It's only, we're only talking about the title of the bill, which is relating to probation or relating to persons convicted of crime. That's the only part that, mm-hmm. that matters as far as what we're talking about here.
But we could not, if I understand you, we could not accept the proposed dash six amendments because it precedes.
Is the dash six amendment, is that the set of amendments that's addressed to the B. Engrossed bill?
Yes. I think what Frank is suggesting is that you have to accept the dash six amendments to get the bill back to the A. Engrossed version.
Back to the A.
Because the B. Engrossed.
Oh, delete. Forgive me. I'm not.
Back to the A. Engrossed version with your amendment so far only as it applies to probation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Forgive me, Frank. I'm not reading the.
It's late on.
Yes.
Well, what's the pleasure of the committee?
I'll move the amendments, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Hamby's moved the dash six amendments. Now, discussion.
The
Senator
effect
Coleman.
Of which is to go back and return to the original relating clause and add and have the Hamby amendments apply only to probationers. Is that correct?
Yes. First half of the Hamby amendments.
I guess I don't have it. No. Okay, I got it now. Yeah.
No, I just have A.
Okay. Not relating the clause, not amending the clause, and if it gives her half of what you want for that, that's fine.
All right, fine. Any objection to that? So ordered. Then Senator Hamby would move House Bill B. Engrossed House Bill as amended 2557 to the floor with a due pass. Call roll, please.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. House Bill 2193, Dale Penn's here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. House Bill 2193, as it is passed by the House and as it comes to you, is Federal Rule 8 for joinder of offenses. And what it does is it expands the rules of joinder under Oregon procedural law so that basically, offenses that are related or offenses of a similar character or offenses that are of the same transaction may be tried in one trial. I've given out to the committee three documents.
I can't resist this. Why do you continually just use the examples? When a person rapes five little girls, he's currently, we said, why don't you figure, you guys in the DA's office, when you come to testify on things like this, figure out some better examples. Okay. It always seems to be what's used, and I have been offended every time we use this kind of example since 1979, and you all continue to use this as a as sort of one way that you think that somehow or another you could figure out a better way to bring your examples and to relate it in those terms.
Senator Cohen, if I may, there's another example of a narcotics prosecution that's
that
also
makes
used.
Me feel just fine.
And I must say, this is testimony that was given at the House side, which I did not prepare. But whether it's rape or sexual abuse or burglary or narcotics, it's the same principle.
I understand that. I'm complaining about the continual use of that single example. Whenever you have a chance to use it in whatever issue, it's always rape being categorized as something that we're supposed to be moved by in some different way than any other the problems that go on throughout this. And I just get offended every time I see it. I think it's part of the whole bias and the way people respond out there in this
sure.
Quickens the sense of outrage.
Yes.
I must say, however, that category of offense is a category of offense that it particularly
in terms of
lends
Georgia.
Itself
I understand,
to.
I understand what you're talking yeah. here, but I still think you could.
Wait a minute, before we get any further. Now, Diana Stewart's back here. Have you seen, you don't have to come up, but have you seen the amendment we're talking about that Mr. Penn is going to present to us?
I was just handing it.
All right, as long as you got it, fine.
Thank you.
Okay. There are lots of amendments here, so I'm trying to lay the groundwork for what this bill does before talking about these amendments. If you look at the last page of the handout that I gave you that says joinder offenses on the first page, and it contains the example Senator Cohen brought to our attention, there is a survey of all the jurisdictions and the joinder statutes that are presently applicable in the United States. What we are asking the committee to do is to allow us to use the federal rules of joinder for offenses, which are presently in operation in the federal courts, which basically have been adopted by 35 of the other states. And that's what that chart shows you is the joinder statutes that are available, and the language that is involved is rather difficult and torturous language to talk about. But basically, it expands the ability to bring cases into one trial before the court. The argument that is made in opposition to this, let me give you one argument in favor of it. It is a cost-effective measure as far as utilizing judicial resources to their maximum. The argument that is used against it is that in some manner it may be prejudicial to a defendant to bring multiple charges into one trial. The response to that, first of all, is that this presently is the law in the federal courts and has been for a number of years. And this statute, as we present it to you, is presently the law in 35 other states. The amendment that I would propose to you today is to adopt Federal Rule 14, which allows severance when there is prejudice shown because there is consolidation of multiple charges into one trial. There is a proposed LC amendment, -1, which brings into line some new language from the ABA, which I would urge you not to consider because, although it tries to get at the idea of prejudicial joinder, the difficulty is no court has ever told us what these words mean. There is no track record. Presently, we have a clear understanding of joinder under Oregon law. And if we're going to go into a new uncharted area, I would simply urge the committee to do nothing on this bill, because the problems I have with the LC-1 amendments are that they are uncharted. We don't know what the words mean. We'll have to go through a lot of litigation at the trial court level and at the appellate level, which I think is going to be unproductive for all sides. And if that was the choice, I would urge you to take no action. The amendment that I have proposed to you as an ODAA proposed amendment to this bill is precisely the same as the LC draft until you get to line 22. and you can see where the typing becomes darker. That is the change, and it basically stays the same except for Section 3, which again is the severance capabilities. And subsection 3 in the ODAA proposed amendment is Federal Rule 14 for severance. And it simply says that when the state or the defendant is prejudiced by a joinder of offenses, then the court may order an election or separate trials or provide whatever other relief it justice requires. I would ask the committee, in adopting that amendment, to also adopt Ninth Circuit, or to take as legislative history the Ninth Circuit interpretations of what is prejudice. And so that is the third handout that I have given you, is a memorandum which talks about joinder, the federal rules, and then lists the exceptions for severance under the Ninth Circuit cases and the reasons given for the courts for allowing severance. And basically it comes down to prejudice to a defendant, whether or not he would have inconsistent defenses at trial and want to have a defense to one charge that's inconsistent with a defense to another charge. In that situation, he'd be allowed to sever those cases.
Commitment criteria and allow for earlier intervention in an episode of deterioration, another bill to provide for outpatient commitment so that a person could be committed not to a hospital, but so that the procedures would be in the law, so that if a person was committed to an outpatient program, they could come back in, they could be, and didn't continue the conditions of their outpatient commitment, they could be returned to a hospital if necessary. The problems that were identified by the interim task force were vast, and I won't take your time to go over all of them. In broad brush, they were the kinds of problems that the first I just mentioned, that a person has to deteriorate to the point of dangerousness to themselves or others, or inability to care before there can be an intervention. The commitment criteria, and I'll only discuss the final product because I think it has been refined considerably in the House Judiciary Committee and in the process. In the final product, a person to be committed under the early intervention criteria would have to first be chronically mentally ill, 18 years of age or over, would have to have had three civil commitments to a state hospital in the past 3 years, and be in an episode of deterioration that would make there's high medical probability within the foreseeable future they would again meet the dangerousness to the self or others or inability to care. What this would allow then is that if a person meets this criteria, there would be an opportunity to place that person in a community program, because the bill also contains provisions for outpatient commitment and for the conditions to be established by the court that, if violated, the person could be returned. These key elements of the bill would allow for that early intervention. Now, there are a whole series of provisions of the bill that deal with another broad problem, and that is that there was not enough information available at the time of the hearings. The various panels that we heard of judges and of attorneys and of families and of psychiatrists and examiners and screeners made it clear that often they were hampered from gathering enough information to provide the court with satisfactory information to make an informed decision at the time of the hearing. There are provisions in this bill to allow the investigators to talk to collaterals, to allow the investigators access to the medical record for the current pre-hearing period of detention, to allow the examiner no longer to have to accomplish a very short-term examination, often occurring now in the courtroom, but would be able to go to the place where the person is being detained during the pre-hearing period of detention on a warranted detention, examine the patient there, interview the treating physician for that pre-hearing period of detention, and have access to the clinical record of that current pre-hearing period of detention. All of these in effort to bring more information into the courtroom at the time of the hearing. The a whole series of problems that were identified by those who testified before the task force and also the oversight group that Senator Hamby mentioned were dealt with through educational approaches. A whole series of things came out of this that didn't result in changes in the statute. There were other streamlining kinds of things, the civil commitment statutes having developed over the years in a patchwork way. For instance, all the periods of hold were different, and that was felt to be unnecessary. Periods of hold for all the different kinds of commitment, peace officer hold, two physician hold, and so forth, civil commitment. Those were all different. Now they're one period of 5 days. The whole statute was reorganized in a way that it flows logically so that you can read it from front to back and it goes through the various processes that occur. Now, I've only hit the highlights, and as people who have followed this closely know, there are a whole series of changes within this bill. One final one I'll mention, and that is the having both sides represented at the time of the hearing caused us to recommend that the district, it is now worded that the governors, that the counties would be responsible for local, the DAs or county council taking the state's case in these situations, and for the Attorney General's office to take the case when they were recommitment hearings, persons who had been committed and were already under commitment and needed to be recommitted. Being very much aware of your time constraints, I could talk about this bill for hours, and I shouldn't.
Okay, now there is, I don't know how much we need to hear. I think Senator Hamby and Senator Cohen or maybe Senator Hill are all up to speed on this. If everybody is aware of exactly what the problem is that we're trying to address, with examples of what the problem has been or is now, then, I mean, I haven't heard anything about that yet. Now, maybe we don't need to go into that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think people have come for ways and would like to testify, and if the two of us need to step out and go to a conference committee, that's one thing. I think they have a minute or two on the record for those.
I think so. I mean, I frankly would like to hear some kind of real-life examples of what it is we're trying to correct here with this situation. So whether it's one of you or some subsequent witness, I think we need something in the record on that. So let's proceed. Coria, you wanted to add something?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as Dr. Bray mentioned, this bill does expand the criteria for civil commitment in a fairly novel way. That does raise some interesting constitutional questions, which I'm prepared to discuss if the committee would like to hear about them.
All right. Now, we have, I don't know how much interest that would be to other committee members, but let me advise committee members that Mark Kramer prepared a memorandum. I don't know whether that's in your file or not, is it? Well, it's not in the file. Anyway, he had some question about the constitutionality of this bill, particularly as it related to the part about being able to commit a person who maybe was not necessarily of danger to himself or others, but who was perceived to be a potential danger. Maybe that was the way. In any event, that memorandum was supplied to the governor's council, and she in turn did some research on that and expanded upon it. And right now, I suppose it's fair to say that at least we can say that this bill is not clearly unconstitutional. And we can also say that the bill is not free of the potential for a constitutional attack. And you might just kind of put a little bit of that thinking in the record, if you would.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. And this issue was raised on the House side, and quite a bit of time was spent on it. The traditional criteria for civil commitment, as Dr. Bray mentioned, are that an individual is either dangerous to himself or society or unable to provide basic care for him or herself. Those two rationales will justify the deprivation of liberty, which goes along with committing someone, for the what you might call the police power. The state has the ability to protect itself and to protect other citizens and to, in fact, protect the person who is being committed if someone is likely to be a danger to themselves. And that in exercising that police power, the Supreme Court has held that you have to find either that the person is dangerous to self or society or that they are unable to care for themselves. The Supreme Court has, however, left open the question of what if you have another goal in mind, that goal being treatment, treating the person so that they do not get to the stage of being dangerous or being unable to care for themselves. This bill is quite carefully tailored to draw in a class of people who can be predicted to a reasonable medical certainty to be deteriorating. They've been previously committed several times, and they're exhibiting precisely the same symptoms that have led to those episodes in the past. It's early intervention. Now, the Supreme Court simply hasn't resolved whether, with that rationale, that early intervention rationale in mind, whether commitment can be made at an earlier stage. There is a Ninth Circuit decision, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, of course, is the one that governs the area that Oregon is a part of. There is a Ninth Circuit decision on the books which suggests that the answer to that question may be no. It's not a decision which goes into this issue in any depth. It's not reasoned particularly well on that basis, but it does suggest that no, only dangerousness or inability to care for yourself is a necessary criteria for commitment. The U.S. Supreme Court hasn't said so and, in fact, has explicitly left the question open. So, as the chair pointed out, this is an open area, cutting edge, really. It may well be that the state will face a constitutional challenge if this law is enacted, but it's certainly, by no means can one say that it is unconstitutional, and the governor's position is there is such a crying need for legislation of this type that we should try it, even if it means that we're the test case.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Senator Hill.
I'm sorry. Corey, what are the criteria again? The person must be committed.
The standard criteria or the criteria.
No, I understand. I mean for the questionable area.
In this bill, the criteria, and Dr. Bray can correct me if I'm wrong, are that the person has been civilly committed under the normal dangerous or inability to care for themselves standards twice in the last 3 years. That they are chronically mentally ill, as determined under the statute and by the mental health department, and that they are exhibiting symptoms which preceded their other episodes of commitment, so that a medical professional can state that they are the phrase may be reasonable medical likelihood going to be committable again.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Dr. Ray? Senator Hill, you'll find the criteria in Section 5 on page 3 of the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
Yes, Senator Hill.
There are some amendments here, the Dash 26 amendments are. Oh, we have counsel there.
Do we know? Are they proposed by?
Yes, I just want to know who are they proposed by.
I can't answer that.
Do we have?
They simply showed up in our
office. Have not seen them, Mr. Chair, Senator Hill.
Okay, just wanted to know.
You're not proposing any amendments, are you?
No.
Thank you.
No. Pretty thick file.
The fact that it's on Dash 26 should tell you something.
Yeah.
Any other questions of these three? All right, fine. We may call you back.
Thank you.
Depending on what we need to find out from you. So let's have Bob. Is that pronounced June Def? All right, come on up, sir.
Good Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff, and I'm the managing attorney of the mental health program of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I'm here to testify against certain portions of the bill today. Having heard what I've heard so far, it sounds like the skids are greased, but I think it's important to bring up a few points for the committee so that you can make reasoned decision on whether it's appropriate to send the bill out as it is.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hammy.
Before you get too far, did you testify on the House side with your concerns?
Yes, I did.
Thank you.
I might add that when I originally testified before the House, I had just assumed my position. I had previously worked with the Metropolitan Public Defender, and I had conducted a great number of commitment hearings. My concerns at that time had to do with a number of the procedural aspects of the bill and how they affected the rights of the mentally ill. Since that time, in my present position, my duties have been to advocate for the rights of the mentally ill in facilities which give them care and treatment, which means that on a weekly basis, I've been attending to clients in both Oregon State Hospital and Dammridge State Hospital, and also those who are served by community mental health clinics. So I have a good sense of how the system works right now. You know, one of the things that's very clear, and I'm sure you've heard quite a bit, is that a problem does exist, that there are large numbers of people who aren't receiving services that need them. And, of course, this bill is designed to address that need. I would submit, however, that the move by the governor that has addressed the need much more directly has been the $7 million critical mass funds that have been provided for the purpose of serving the population. Highly needed money. This is the type of money that will allow community mental health clinics to reach out to the people who are in need of services and give those services to those individuals. In other words, not forced treatment, but convincing people the wisdom of treatment and providing that treatment in a reasonable way. The expanded criteria that you have before you, you've heard a great deal about the constitutionality of those criteria. You've received two opinions from the Attorney General that have indicated to you that it is not absolutely unconstitutional. And it is, in fact, it says very specifically that it is giving you this opinion for the purposes of your knowing that it is not absolutely unconstitutional so that you can pass it with good conscience. However, it is important to point out that there is direct case law in opposition to that opinion, that case law is controlling in the Ninth Circuit. And it has not been overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the next court of appeals above the Ninth Circuit, which means that it is the law of this jurisdiction, of the federal jurisdiction at this time. It exists for a very good reason, and that is that people's freedom should not be taken away from them unless they have committed a crime or they have engaged in activity which is dangerous to society in some manner, that being dangerous to themselves or others, or they are unable to care for themselves to the extent that they are, in fact, dangerous to themselves. Next, a person who was committed under the expanded criteria can be placed either in the hospital or an outpatient commitment under the provisions of this act. It's important for committee members to understand where a person will be sent if they are sent to a mental hospital in this state. They'll either be sent to Dammridge State Hospital or to Oregon State Hospital. Both of those facilities are now exactly the same situation that Fairview Training Center is. They've been decertified by the Healthcare Financing Administration because they do not have adequate staff to care for the patients, and the treatment that the patients are receiving in those facilities is, let us say, not the best. The mood at Dammridge State Hospital right now could best be termed as the people who work there are in a siege mentality, and this will be confirmed by anyone who works there. They're swimming against the tide. They have too many people, not enough resources to do the job that they need to do. There's no guarantee that anybody who goes into that facility will get adequate care. And if they're fortunate enough to get better in that facility, there's absolutely no guarantee that they'll return to the community and get adequate care, even under the terms of this bill. In addition, if a person were to be committed under this bill as an outpatient, they will be outside of the criteria which you're going to be establishing within the period of commitment. And again, they will have no guarantee of services or ongoing services. The reason I point this out is that creating a better mental health system in the state means coming up with creative solutions to people's problems and funding those solutions. But the solution does not lie in a wholesale attack upon what the rights that the chronically mentally ill now enjoy that other people enjoy. And I'd urge this committee, although I know that my urgings are probably going to fall upon deaf ears today, to take that into consideration and understand that this is a quick fix type of solution that will not have the desired effect, and it is a solution that will deprive people of rights rather than provide them in a manner that does not provide them with adequate services.
Do you have a suggestion on what the state ought to do with individuals who fall into the criteria that are set out in this bill, that is, people who are not yet at the point where they could be legally committed, but they are, by every sign or symptom or history, are a time bomb waiting to go off? What do we do with those people?
I'd suggest two things. One is that I'm sure Dr. Bray will tell you, as he's told me, that a number of the people who he has on his list of individuals are presently in state mental hospitals. They are at risk, and they tend to go into the hospitals. But those people can be earmarked and provided with adequate discharge planning and provided adequate services when they come out. That'll take care of a good slice of those people. Secondly, it's essential, and I think Dr. Bray would also agree with me on this, that if community mental health programs were able to create true case management services, which means that they had the adequate staff to reach out and follow people in the community, that they'd do a much better job at being able to prevent people from getting into the type of condition that they are, that this bill seeks to address. It's a longer-term solution, and it takes resources, but it is a way that can provide services to people that does not treat them as a suspect class different than other individuals in our society. And it will also have the ultimate objective, although not overnight, as perhaps this bill would like, of getting the services to that people and addressing the heartache and tragedy of individuals that are in this position and the resulting heartache that they cause their families.
Yes, Senator Hamby.
You mentioned if there was adequate monitoring and case management, et cetera. How, following discharge, let's assume that for a moment, and the former patient, discharged patient, decides that they will no longer take their medication, how will you as case manager ensure that that medication is taken?
Well, one thing that in my experience in working with case managers is that, first of all, they have high caseloads, and so they...
I'm just asking you, if you were a case manager...
Right, you reached that point.
How would you force that recently discharged patient to return to medication to prevent him, hopefully, from relapsing into a condition that caused the original commitment?
Yes.
You left us all hanging out there. Please explain.
I understand your point. I think I can answer two things, and if you'll let me get to the second. The first is that unless the person's committed, of course, they can't be forced to take medication. Part of their treatment, either in a hospital or with a community mental health program, should be to... if they need medication, to be able to convince them of the benefits of that
and
encourage them to take it.
How would you do that
now,
if they refused?
If they refuse. In my work with people, this seems to be an ongoing process of, in fact, Dr. Cutler from Health Sciences once said to me that a great deal of the job that he does is trying to talk people into taking medication and encourage them to see the wisdom of doing that. And this is, I suspect, not being a psychiatrist myself, that this is a process that happens in the community level also. Of course, our laws only allow us to keep a hold on individuals for so long. I don't think we're at the point where once a person becomes mentally ill, they become permanently committed. So there will always be a point under this statute or any other statute when a person either comes out of the hospital or at some point along the term of their treatment where there isn't going to be the government with the hand on the shoulder saying, you have to do what we say.
I guess I'm assuming that as a case manager, you yourself witness your the former patient deteriorate and continue to deteriorate. What would you do?
One thing that I would try to do is often done if I think that patient is deteriorating is that I would, in the past, encourage them to go to the hospital, and I would meet with them and I would encourage them to do that on a voluntary basis. Of course, that can't be done now because the mental health division or Stamish State Hospital has stopped taking voluntary patients because of their overload, and the mental health division is encouraging both Oregon State Hospital and Eastern Hospital to stop taking voluntary patients because of their overloads. And so I would be frustrated at that point since voluntary treatment on that basis doesn't even exist, and I would be in a situation where I'd have to say you have to degenerate to the point where you can be committed rather than obtaining voluntary services if you need them. This is sort of the flip, the backwards type of approach that I think is indicative of this type of legislation. There aren't the adequate avenues to reach people without a legal arm. There aren't adequate resources to do that, and in fact, the state has blocked voluntary treatment on a number of levels by inadequately funding mental health clinics and not allowing voluntary patients into the state hospitals. And so, yes, people are forced to decompensate to the point of being committable, large bodies of them. But I would suggest to you that it isn't merely as a result of the fact that they're mentally ill that this happens, but it has to do with the entire network of treatment that they're afforded.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
Do you offer any language at all on the House side that perhaps spoke to the issue of eminence or anything else that would assist this legislation?
I did not speak at length as to the expanded criteria other than offering my opinion that it was constitutionally suspect. And in fact, I don't think that you're going to find that language. There was an attempt to do it here. To draw it narrowly, but my personal legal opinion is that, of course, no one can say with certainty that anything is unconstitutional in this day and age, but that it's very open to attack, and it probably will be attacked very quickly. I'd like to add also that there are other aspects of the bill besides the expanded criteria. And many of those aspects are sorely needed and beneficial. However, again, there are some that overlook certain aspects of basic fundamental rights of any person when they enter into a judicial proceeding. For example, while normal rules of confidentiality of treatment have been waived for patients in the pre-commitment period, which might be arguable, but I won't take issue with this committee. For those who are proposed to be committed under the expanded criteria, Section 10.2c indicates that the state decides exactly how many medical records can be looked at. It's not limited to merely the pre-detention period in which a person has been warned that they don't have any rights of confidentiality here, which is fair enough. You come in and say, listen, whatever you say can be used against you. But it allows the mental health division to go back into prior records with absolutely no bounds and no controls so that a person's prior medical history and treatment is an open book as long as the state determines that that person might come under the expanded criteria that you're considering. This is also this wide open area is also available as to what the mental examiners will be able to see. In other words, it's up to the mental health division. If the mental health division says you can go look at any medical record that this person's had in the past, it seems to be okay. under the law as it's proposed.
Can you kind of, were you able to kind of wrap it up here now?
Okay. One last thing, because I think this may be an important thing also. I have been part of many commitment proceedings, Mr. Chairman, not in which the district attorney has been part of the process, where I've spoken with many people about the effect that the district attorney has in the process. And my experience with that, and from what I've told, is that having a district attorney present does not change the outcome, but generally tends to speed the process somewhat, because the district attorney is able to talk to the witnesses ahead of time, sort of winnow through some of the information and present it in a little bit quicker fashion to a court. Because of this, I was concerned that $200,000 of money that would go for treatment of people is now going to go to district attorneys to conduct hearings under the being grossed version. Mentally ill persons aren't going to get any benefit of that money. The only benefit you'll see is probably in some judicial budgets. And because of that, I would suggest that is a bad resolution. If district attorneys are wanted, the money for those district attorneys should come out of judicial budgets, because that's the area where costs will be saved, not in treatment or care of mentally ill people.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions? All right. Okay, thanks. Well, we couldn't give the DA's House Bill 2193, so we're going to give them this one. Let's see. Let's hear a couple of quick comments now from Dan Barnes and Bob Lockwood, the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office, who are listed as opponents. I encourage brevity.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Don Barnes. I'm a member of the Metropolitan Public Defender staff. Bob Lockwood can't be here today. In addition to being with the Metropolitan Public Defender staff, I was a member of the State Task Force for Civil Commitment of the Mentally Ill, and a member of the Multnomah County Task Force dealing with potentially dangerous or chronically mentally ill. Very briefly, I believe that under the state of the law right now, today, this bill is clearly unconstitutional. The standard was first established by the United States Supreme Court in 1975 in O'Connor versus McDonald, which held that the minimum requirement for deprivation of freedom of a mentally ill person is either dangerousness to self or others, or inability to care for personal needs. In 15 years, the court has not retreated one bit from that position. The position of the Ninth Circuit is somewhat stronger in Suzuki versus UN, which was decided in 1980. That court said not just dangerous, but imminent dangerousness. So it appears that under the law right now, which is easily accessible to people, this bill would be unconstitutional.